You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Yeah, I am a scientist. Yeah, I am a scientist. Yeah, I am a scientist. We gotta live on science alone now.
Welcome to Unbiased Science, where we bring scientific method to the madness. We're your hosts, Dr. Jess Steyer.
And Dr. Andrea Love.
And this week, we are back with the Nadolsky boys, the docs who lift, Drs. Spencer and Carl Nadolsky, who will introduce themselves in just one moment, to tackle another scientist who has sort of teetered into the pseudoscience space. That is the glucose goddess, who has a new supplement that we'll talk about in detail in just one moment. Spence and Carl, do you want to just introduce yourselves briefly?
All right. Age before youth, I guess. All right. So Carl Nadolsky, I am a board certified endocrinologist, internal medicine specialist, and obesity specialist. I am currently the chief of endocrinology, obesity, and diabetes at Holland Hospital, assistant professor of medicine for Michigan State University. And I am Spencer's co-host for the Docs Who Lift podcast, and we do a lot of, especially in my world, a lot of obesity, diabetes, metabolic disease, and obviously other hormones.
I am Spencer Nadolsky, the younger brother, taller brother, and I
slightly skinnier, less girth,
but definitely more girth. I am a board-certified family medicine physician, specialized in obesity medicine, something called lipidology, the study of lipids like cholesterol and triglycerides and that type of thing. And I am a meme lord on Instagram.
Meme lord.
So. Apparently not as much as our topic today.
Yeah. So let's just set the stage with who this person is that we're going to be talking about. So you all probably know her as the glucose goddess, but her actual name is Jessie Inchauspe. She has over 3.3 million followers on Instagram. She leverages her platform to preach about blood sugar and also to sell various products. She does hold a master's degree in biochemistry, but some of the scientific merit of her content is debatable, and we're really going to dig in today. We'll get into the specifics. And again, as I mentioned, she's now delving into supplements. She recently made waves with the announcement of her latest venture called the Anti-Spike Formula. And so this new supplement is currently available for pre-order for $65, with shipments starting in April, and it promises to combat the dreaded post-meal blood sugar spike. It's marketed as a natural solution. She really emphasizes its 100% natural ingredients, touting it as gut-friendly, sugar-free, vegan, and gluten-free. So, and I know we're going to get into this in some of her claims, but just to get into what the ingredients are for the anti-spike recipe. So there are four main ingredients. And these are white mulberry leaf, which is touted to potentially slow down carbohydrate absorption, lemon and cinnamon extracts, touted to have potential blood sugar management benefits, and the intriguing, quote, glucose goddess antioxidants, which are a proprietary blend of undisclosed vegetable extracts. And as we'll get into, those first three ingredients that we just mentioned, they do have some extremely limited, mainly preclinical research to support some of these claims, but there's really no solid clinical evidence that they work. And even more than that, the supplement itself has not been studied. So there have been no clinical trials on all these ingredients together and the supplement itself.
And if anything, correct me if I'm wrong, but all those little bitty studies that are, you know, really don't have a lot of great data behind them. They were in people with dysglycemia, meaning like type 2 diabetes, not in healthy people without diabetes
So that's right? Exactly right, Carl. I actually went and pulled the studies that she put screenshots of in her, like, this is the data behind my new supplement. And, you know, the first study was looking at specifically just mulberry leaf or mulberry leaf extract. And it was with people who had, it was actually a meta-analysis on studies studies of people with glycemic issues. So dyslipidemia, type two diabetes, and so on. The second study she cited was solely for individuals with type two diabetes. And it was a randomized controlled crossover trial, but it wasn't just mulberry leaf extract. It also included other things, especially fiber, which we know is very important for regulating digestion and blood sugar. And that trial only had 30 people. So very, very small to begin with. And then the last study she cites was funded and conducted by the company that produces Reducose, which is the specific brand of mulberry extract that she's putting in her anti-spike pill. So that's a pretty big conflict of interest there. And again, that study was only 38 individuals across, you know, arms, and they only looked at blood sugar changes when you're consuming just sucrose, just table sugar, right? There's nothing else involved. You're not looking at it in the context of food or anything. So, you know, there's obvious flaws in the claims she's making. And what's more concerning is that this really goes to the crux of pseudoscience, right? It takes these nuggets of truth or these mechanistic ideas, and it really exaggerates it, and it sells it to people under the guise of health, when in reality, there are things that we probably should be focusing on much more than buying these supplements that have no benefits. And what's really frustrating is that, you know, there was actually an interview in today.com, and we're airing this on Wednesday, but this was on last Thursday. But basically she's saying that, you know, her goal is to break down glucose related research into fun, digestible, and easy to understand graphs and social media posts. She sees herself as a science translator between studies and the general public, but in reality, she's doing the opposite. And many critics of her have said that she propagates pseudoscience, she advocates a method that is not supported by evidence, and the studies that she cites routinely are either anecdotal, false, completely misinterpreted, or not relevant to the things she's claiming.
And just one thing before, you know, Spencer and Carl, obviously we really want to hear from you from the clinical perspective, but there was one statistic that I saw all over her page in regard to this particular supplement. She says that it will moderate glucose spikes by up to 40% if taken before a carb-rich meal. Andrew, did you see that statistic? I could not find where that was coming from.
It was coming from that very first study that she was citing. That was a review of some other studies with people with glycemic issues. And it was essentially, you know, looking at, you know, variability in blood sugar levels with some of these mulberry leaf extracts that were tested in some of these studies that were included in this meta-analysis. But of course, it's not looking at her actual supplement or her actual formulation, or even a large scale population that's representative of the population at large, right? You know, as Carl said, these studies were in people who have blood sugar issues to begin with, but she's marketing this for everyone because she makes the claim that fluctuations in your blood sugar are going to lead to insulin resistance, which is going to lead to type 2 diabetes. So I think that's really, you know, the problem is she's essentially telling everybody that they need to go buy this $65 per month supplement, which has no evidence to support it.
And of course, it's more expensive than really good medications that we have for type 2 diabetes that have real huge data behind them and actual outcomes that we know, both good and bad, that we can talk about. And it goes all the way back to, why the heck do we even care about people's blood sugar?
And I want you guys to really kind of, you know, talk people through, like, what, you know, why we detect glucose in the blood after eating, how is it regulated? Talk a little bit about the glucose insulin pathway, and what is the relationship really between blood glucose increases after eating, postprandial blood glucose increases, and risk for type 2 diabetes or insulin resistance. So maybe you two can walk us through that.
Yeah, so well, let's talk about type 1 diabetes a second, because that's where we get a lot of the data for why we don't want people to have hyperglycemia. A normal fasting blood glucose is less than 100 milligrams per deciliter. When it's over, when it's 126 or over, that's consistent with hyperglycemia to the point we call diabetes of any flavor, right? A 2-hour post-glucose challenge after like a 2-hour glucose tolerance test, we call it. If it's over 200 milligrams per deciliter, that's consistent with diabetes. Again, type 1, type 2, there's some other different types of diabetes. But hyperglycemia to the point where this is a huge problem. Pre-diabetes is essentially in between those two things. We have something called the hemoglobin A1C, which is really just, I tell people, it's a way we measure the average estimated average sugar over 3 months, because red blood cells live 3 months. They get glycated, meaning from the levels of glucose, and it correlates to an average sugar. So for example, a hemoglobin A1C of 7, which is a goal for a lot of people with any type of diabetes to reduce the risk that we're going to talk about, is about an average of 154, 155 milligrams per deciliter, just to give you a little bit of context. So type 1 diabetes, where we get a lot of the data for why hyperglycemia is a problem, it's an autoimmune disease. There can be secondary causes where your pancreas doesn't work, doesn't make insulin. Insulin is what is secreted by the pancreas when we consume foods that get broken down and start raising our blood glucose. There are different phases of the insulin secretion. There's an initial first phase, and then there's a second phase. This gets into, Spencer and I were just talking with somebody about the incretins or the GLP-1 hormones, the GIP, these other gut hormones that help stimulate the pancreas when it starts to sense nutrients. And the insulin goes up, it goes to target cells throughout the body to essentially pull the glucose in and be used or stored, et cetera. There are many parts of the body that actually don't use insulin, by the way. That's actually where some of the complications come from. So in type 1 diabetes, though, autoimmune disease used to be thought of as juvenile, but it can happen actually anytime to anybody, where the pancreas stops working. The beta cells that make insulin, they stop working, and we develop hyperglycemia. Acute hyperglycemia, when someone has that and they don't have any insulin, it's very catabolic, because now they don't have anything to get the glucose into the muscle cells. You end up with an acidosis. It's called diabetic ketoacidosis, potentially, which is life-threatening. People lose glucose through their urine. They become very dehydrated. They lose a lot of weight. That's kind of the short-term issues. But even if we can't keep their glucoses to some degree controlled, and we'll talk about those goals and what those mean, the long-term complications include microvascular disease. When we talk about microvascular disease, it's retinopathy, so eye disease. It's the leading cause of blindness, nephropathy, kidney disease, neuropathy, nerves. When the issue with all these types of microvascular things is that nerve, retinal in your eyes and kidney cells, they don't require insulin for intracellular glucose entry. So then when they're exposed to the glucose levels in the presence of insulin deficiency, whether it's absolute, like in like young onset type 1 diabetes, or even relative, which we'll talk about with the insulin resistance development of type 2 diabetes, then it results in the intracellular metabolic dysfunction and increased risk of all those problems. And so for those with type 1 diabetes, I'll just talk about the big, huge trial that was like the landmark trial in reducing glucose levels in people with type 1 diabetes, the DCCT, okay, in type 1 diabetes. And basically, it was when we were starting to develop better insulins to better mimic our own physiology. That insulin technology has not been great for a long time. We're talking back in the 80s when we didn't have good ways to measure glucose. You should talk to people who have had type 1 diabetes since then. It's amazing, totally different than what we do now. And so they basically randomized people to the old conventional standard with a goal of a hemoglobin A1C of 9%, mind you. So 9% is like an average glucose of 212 milligrams per deciliter. Okay. And they did intensive insulin management, basal insulin, which your pancreas should always be secreting a little bit of insulin to keep your fasting sugars at bay. Again, normal under 100. But these days, our goal is really to have it under 130 or maybe under 110 if they have type 1 diabetes. And then bolus insulin with their meals to cover their meals, which generally is a goal to kind of keep that under 180 if we can. And the A1C goal for that intensive therapy was 7%. So they reduced the average A1C from 9, an average of 212 sugar to basically 155. Okay. And they reduced the rates over 7 years of complications, 50 to 75%. And then everyone got intensive therapy because this was a huge deal. It's like, oh, okay, we got to keep people's sugars better. Right. And then everyone got randomized to, or changed to the more intensive therapy, which is similar to what we do now. We do way better now, by the way, than we even did back when this trial came out. And there was this thing called the legacy effect. So people still had residual benefits down the road from that first 6.5 years of intensive therapy. And then after a really, really, really long time follow-up, like 27 years, there were also what we call macrovascular benefits, heart disease, like reducing heart attacks, et cetera. But there are other things that go along with diabetes. They also had some of that kidney disease and they had protein in the urine that was correlated to cardiovascular detriment in addition to the hemoglobin A1C. And the mortality, the death benefit was there, but it was actually pretty modest. It was barely statistically significant. And this is after 30 years. So the intensive therapy group getting the A1C down to 7% early on and then continuing on, it ultimately resulted in a mortality, meaning death rate, similar to a relatively healthy non-diabetic population. So from those data, we know that getting A1Cs, average sugars, from down to 155 is really good. That's where you get the most bang for your buck. We can try to get some people, especially younger, healthy people, down to an A1C of 6.5 if they have type 1 diabetes with insulin, as long as we don't cause hypoglycemia and other problems, and you get a little bit more benefit. You go down to 6, there's a little bit of benefit. The absolute benefit is not really there. The relative benefit is still there, right? So that's a statistical thing. But the absolute benefit just starts to become minimal, and the risks become more. And so it's one of those point of limiting returns, yeah. Right? And so that's why we don't push people with type 1 diabetes to really, really low levels. Now with, I'm jumping around, but you know, with our really, really good technology now, we can do a little bit better than that because we can do it safely. But it just goes to show you that that's long time average significant hyperglycemia, not just these little bitty healthy person average glucose excursions that go maybe up to 140, because 99% of the time, healthy people without any insulin resistance or type 1 diabetes, even with ice cream or some sugar that she talks about, our sugars aren't going to go up and stay up long enough to probably really cause any problems that are an issue
right.
Anyhow. So that's a type 1 diabetes study, and that took a long time, more than I thought. So
what you're saying is that a lot of the kind of premise or the false premise that's being used is looking at people who don't have a normally functioning pancreas. They're not able to actually control their blood sugars by secreting insulin, which promotes the uptake and the utilization of it. And they're seeing these complications as a result of this extended, long-term, excessively high blood sugar, which is not what's going to happen with people who have normal functioning pancreas right. and normal insulin signaling.
And there's something to some of the real short-term things that happen when we have really high glucose spikes, which is where I know a lot of these people like to cherry pick some of that concept. But again, we're talking about big picture stuff. And this also happens in type 2 diabetes. So just to quickly go through, you know, type 2 diabetes, it's really a disease of obesity, technically, where we carry an energy balance where we have excess adipose tissue. Our healthy adipose tissue cells don't work that well. We start to develop more visceral obesity, meaning we get adipose tissue in our gut, in our liver, and in our pancreas. That whole thing basically leads to insulin resistance. Our healthy fat cells aren't working. We have more inflammation. That's, you know, obesity, metabolic syndrome, heart disease stuff also. And the adipose, the triglyceride that gets into the muscles and the liver and then the pancreas can't keep up with those insulin demands. That's when you start to lose those phases of insulin I talked about, and a relative insulin deficiency and hyperglycemia. We have studies for type 2 diabetes going way back before we had some of these really, really good medications using metformin, which helps muscle and liver use sugar better, a little bit of weight loss benefits, but also using things called sulfonylureas, where they just stimulate the pancreas to make more insulin, and also just using insulin. And those trials going back to the 80s and 90s, the UKPDS, the Accord Advance and VADT in the high cardiovascular risk people do also show same sort of thing. When we get A1Cs from 9 to 7 or from 8 to 7, a more intensive therapy, we have microvascular benefits kind of across the board, and they're enduring. Now, the problems come into those big cardiovascular outcome trials where those people who were given metformin seem to have some benefit for sure. But the people who were given a lot of insulin, there were some concerns of hypoglycemia and maybe higher death rate actually in one arm of the intensive arm of the one called ACCORD, if anybody wants to nerd out and look that stuff up. So there was really, the brakes were put on intensive glycemic control in people with long-standing type 2 diabetes at high cardiovascular risk. And then the concept of, well, how are we getting these sugars down? So another medication that has a lot of theoretical good benefits in lipid metabolism called rosiglitazone was one of the medications used in these trials where there were some signals for, heart attack reduction, all that stuff, but then higher mortality, for example, in some of them that really, raised those concerns, leading to what we now have are these huge, mega numbers of people, high cardiovascular risk studies to see not only are we making sugars better, losing weight, et cetera, but are we actually getting health outcomes, cardiovascular outcomes? So rosiglitazone turned out not to be so good. Using insulin intensely just to have better sugars in people with type 2 diabetes, maybe not so good. Type 1 diabetes, it's different. It's a complete deficiency, but we can't have hypoglycemia and some of these other problems. And then, the other glitazone, TZD, called pioglitazone, actually probably has more of the benefits with some caveats too, though. All things have side effects. And when we talk about supplements, if they are doing anything, it means they are actually medicine. Right. So they're medicinal. So these itty bitty little studies that look like they have some benefits, they might be great. Cinnamon, probably great. There's enough data on cinnamon to say, well, at least it's safe. And if people want to put it in their oatmeal, great. Although she might say not to eat oatmeal because you might get a little bit of a glucose spike, when in reality, type 2 diabetes, by the way, we got to treat the underlying root issue of the obesity to prevent the downstream hyperglycemia and all the problems.
You actually brought up a really good point, right? Because you made the point of, with type 1 diabetes, which is an autoimmune disorder, you don't have a functioning pancreas, you're not producing insulin, you're not able to regulate your blood sugar whatsoever. But in type 2 diabetes, sometimes overuse of insulin or use of insulin in a very intense manner, it's controlling the blood sugar, but it's not improving health outcomes. And that really underlies the fact that there's a lot more to health than just what your blood sugar levels, especially when you do have a functioning pancreas. So Spencer, maybe you can kind of walk through, like, okay, in a healthy person, what should we expect postprandially? What is normal blood glucose extrusion? Why is this not something that people need to be concerned about?
The real question is, do little glucose spikes, depending on if you eat an apple versus you eat a cheese stick or whatever, or anything like that, do these glucose excursions matter when you don't have the underlying pathophysiology or pathology? Like type 1 diabetes, obviously you're not making insulin. Type 2 diabetes, it's not the glucose spike per se, it's the underlying pathology of what my brother was talking about, the insulin resistance. So in a normal person, again, we've had a few CGM
with you, in fact.
Yeah,
right?
And we'll get CGMs there again.
You expect to, if you eat some sort of form of carbohydrate that breaks down into glucose, and most things do, unless you're somehow getting the fructose of just pure fructose. I don't know how you're going to get that, but most carbohydrate containing foods are going to contain either starch that gets broken down into glucose or pure glucose itself. And you're going to see some sort of spike. And you can see it on the glucose goddesses, her little graphs and things like that. And you can do it yourself for the CGMs, and we'll talk about, potential risks of this. But in general, you see, and my brother talked about it, you can do actual, like a standardized 75 grams of glucose, and you watch, you can watch the blood sugars over time. And, if they remain elevated over 2 hours at over 200, you have type 2 diabetes. And then 140 milligrams per deciliter, if it's over that at 2 hours, you have what's called pre-diabetes. And my brother talked about the A1C, but a 5.7% A1C up to 6.5 is pre-diabetes as well. So in a normal person, though, that doesn't have pre-diabetes, you can expect an A1C below 5.6 and below. And then you'd also not expect to see postprandial blood sugars above 140 at 2 hours. But in general, if people that wear CGMs, you'll see like this kind of little blip. And I've had some other blips when I tried to eat a ton of brownies, like at one time. But in general, it's normal to see these glucose excursions. So the real question is, should we even be worrying about this? We had a whole podcast ourselves with Dr. Guest, and she's a really smart RD PhD. And she goes over it very in quite detail in some of her articles about this may be pathologizing. Yes. It makes you worried about glucose spikes in normal, healthy people. It's normal.
You should, because what it means is that your body is extracting the energy from the food you just ate, and then your blood sugar goes up, and then your pancreas works and secretes insulin, and then your blood sugar goes down, and you have this negative feedback loop that is very tightly regulated in people that have functioning pancreases. And so what this does is it pathologizes it, but it creates this health anxiety, and it creates this like information overload where people are fixated on looking at their blood sugar level when there isn't a clinical reason for it. When in reality, there are a lot of other things that are going to lead to, you know, health outcomes and all of these sorts of things.
Yeah, I would be more worried about the underlying pathophysiology. I would be worried about if the CGM or your blood sugars, it kind of shows patterns of insulin resistance. You don't need a CGM to really find those types of things, though. We already know we should probably be physically active. We should get good amounts of sleep. We should probably be as lean as we can as possible. So these little what they're trying to insinuate, and I know this because I'm in this realm, is that these glucose spikes will then cause insulin resistance. And I don't know her specifically.
She said that, but I know
many people.
So basically,
and that's I thought that when I was going through med school, and I didn't quite understand and grasp the whole thing. I didn't. And that's what kind of drove me down into learning more about type 2 diabetes as an obesity driven, you know, adiposity based insulin resistant disease, and how treating the obesity is what treats it.
So not
the glucose spikes. You can do it with a low fat, high carb diet, low carb, you know, high fat, all the different things. It doesn't matter what your glucose spikes are.
When you actually look at the evidence, there is no robust evidence that there's a causal link between the number of glucose extrusions, the severity of them, and risk for developing type 2 diabetes. So. Mm-hmm.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
The underlying pathophysiology of type 2 diabetes and insulin resistance is energy excess
and genetics and how that energy excess ends up, you know, affecting individuals
where you store it. So because people could eat mostly carbohydrates in a lower calorie manner, and they're not going to develop type 2 diabetes or insulin resistance. It's not going to happen.
We're talking about kind of like the pathologizing of these sorts of excess health monitoring and supplements and things like that. And I think, you know, I want to talk about the continuous glucose monitors in just a second, but I think, you know, one thing that people often are like, and I was reading some of the comments because there were some very valid critiques of her supplement, about how there haven't been clinical studies that there's no evidence that normal people, you know, you should have these fluctuations in blood sugar. This is a normal process and it's regulated by your body. Your body's really great at sensing and regulating these things. And that she's kind of promoting this disordered behavior, this disordered eating. And the bigger problem is that platforming this type of pseudoscience really is linked to belief in medical conspiracism and rejection of evidence-based science. And we see that there was a study in JAMA back in 2014, and they find that there's a direct kind of relationship between number of medical conspiracies respondents agreed with. And these are things from vaccines are harmful to they include microchips to pesticides are poisoning us to, you know, sunscreen causes skin cancer, all of these things. But as people believe more and more of those, they also, a higher proportion of them use herbal supplements. They, you know, stop going to the doctor to get preventative physicals. They stop getting their flu shots. They stop using sunscreen. They stop visiting the dentist. So it's beyond just, oh, she's selling a supplement. If you don't believe in it, don't buy it. It's really, it's fomenting this environment of medical conspiracies being, you know, aligning with this herbal supplement industry.
After our Andrew Huberman podcast, there are people saying like, what's the harm? What's the, and we talked about this in the podcast, and he's an overall net positive. And I would say, how do you know that? It could be an overall net negative just by the many flu shots that just got avoided. And so with this, you think, what's the harm? So if people start, you know, looking at their blood sugars more, the harm is a high amount of anxiety, not eating foods that are pretty healthful for you, despite higher glycemic excursions. That's the harm. The harm. Do you know how much anxiety? Like, I got anxiety when I got an A1C that was 5.6 one time. I got a glucometer. I was like, what the hell's going on? And then I tested it again. It was like 5.2. I was like, what? And I got a
CGM. These things are not perfect.
And I got a CGM. Yeah. And one time it was faulty. And I was like, oh, I have type 2 diabetes. That's it. It went up to 200. The rep called me down. Let me get you a replacement I guess I'll probably get sued if I say the name of it, but it's one of the most popular CGMs out there. Mm-hmm. So, and I got a replacement. It's like, oh, it's fine. I did try to stress test it with brownies and pizza, and I saw it go up and then it went right back down. And it doesn't in normal eating, it was completely fine. So the pathology, there's a lot of anxiety. And then also, people don't think about the harm to their wallets, and we don't know, like, these supplements. So, okay. So I was just looking
at the side effects,
the mulberry extract. I did see there was a normal glycemic, healthy population. They did, do a study and there's probably some effects. We have these alpha glucosidase inhibitors. It inhibits the breakdown of starch in our guts. And so you don't absorb it. It goes through you. So when you're thinking about these supplements though, you think about proprietary blends and all these different things. And this is why we had a supplement called glycosulf. So we were glucose gods in the day, but
we went broke because we're not quacks.
We didn't make it proprietary. It was berberine was in it. And, I don't know if she has berberine in the,
It's probably coming.
So anyway, the reason we stopped doing it is because we couldn't, ethically, we couldn't recommend it over guideline-directed medicated.
That are really good, that have great data, and we know the safety. Well,
you look at these small studies that she's putting together, then combine them all. You can't just...
You just said something really important. It's the number one question that we have to ask anytime you're reading a study is, oh, she's saying these things are great. Compared to what? You know, because these things, first of all, there have been no studies about the supplement, and there have been no head-to-head studies with the supplement versus actual, as you just said, you know, clinically backed recommendations. And the other thing is something that really pisses Andrea and me off quite a bit is this appeal to nature fallacy. And the glucose goddess is really leaning into it with that whole all natural thing. That, you know, we know that herbal extracts can have very serious adverse effects on people. There could be dangerous drug interactions.
They're unregulated.
They can cause acute liver and kidney toxicity. There's a link here we'll put in our show notes. Supplement overdosing accounted for 20% of liver damage and hepatotoxicity.
Hepatotoxicity.
Okay. In the U.S., I read it. I don't say it out loud. Sorry. In the U.S. in 2017, and that number is obviously definitely a lot higher now because we know that supplements have just been a booming industry. So when people are like, well, what is the harm? These are just herbal supplements. There can be actual harms that, you know,
with the herbal supplements, especially the proprietary blends, you know, there's a lot of plants out there that are very toxic at very low doses. And you know, you can't, you have no way of knowing this, right? She's selling these things. She's using this loophole in the supplement industry by saying it's proprietary to pretend like it's trade secret. And that's why she doesn't want to disclose it. But then you have literally no idea of what you're putting into your body. And it's very confounding that the people that are so, you know, resistant to FDA approved regulated medications that have safety and efficacy data, and they always harp on ingredients, are perfectly fine consuming things that have no visibility into the ingredients.
Well, that gets to my point, Spencer, is that then we have real people with actual disease who might be falling for this, right? So they might have real obesity, real prediabetes metabolic syndrome, or real type 2 diabetes, who are then going, oh yeah, I need to do what, you know, do what Glucose Goddess is saying, which if they followed her dietary advice, wouldn't be wrong. We've talked about this offline. It's pretty good, actually. But then, it's the same thing everyone says. because it's very, very reasonable. But then if they choose that over medications that we now have that do lower glucose for real in true diabetes or prediabetes, hyperglycemia, prevent diabetes, doing the right nutrition exercise for the weight reduction, and have the macrovascular outcome benefits that we were just talking about, that's huge harm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say that, like, I'm trying to think of how I would approach if I were her and how I would do a business. I'd probably have like a little guidebook for those with pre-diabetes and type 2 diabetes. The supplement thing, I wouldn't make it proprietary. I would use the most rigorously studied supplements. I would make, and then I would probably, if I'm making enough money, I'd try to fund some sort of study and then say, look, if you're somebody that doesn't tolerate all these other medicines, I don't know. I'm trying to think of how I would do it ethically, but like, to me,
that's why we didn't do it. That's why we got out of the game.
But the other thing is that you two are looking at it in the context of taking this if you have disease, right? She's marketing this for everyone. She says it is a supplement for the thousands of people who have asked me for a supplement to support their glucose journey. I am so proud of this formula, so proud of this product. I know you will love it as much as I do. It's the best supplement in the market with gold standard science backing it. And you take 2 capsules once a day before the meal of your day, highest in carbs or sugar. It's very similar to how you would use vinegar. If you want a little extra help to keep your glucose steady, to help your insulin resistance, again, she's suggesting that regular people are developing insulin resistance, but also helping your cravings and your fatigue, Anti-Spike has got your back. So she's also lumping in cravings and fatigue, which have many, many potential causes, right? We know people get weird cravings when they're depressed, when hormones are fluctuating. You can be fatigued for a variety of things, but she's saying, well, it's all because your blood glucose is spiking and your pancreas isn't properly working, which of course is not the case.
Where is a supplement going to be available? Is it going to be available
on
the United
website.
States?
Yeah. Yeah.
Everywhere.
Yeah. So here's the thing. I mean, we can tell this quick story. We talked about this on our podcast with our supplement called Glycosolve. Again, it's not available anymore, but I had a marketing team that basically I gave them the studies of here's pure berberine, 500 milligrams, 97 or 98% pure. Here are the studies. And they came up with these claims of like lowers blood sugar by XYZ and those with type 2. It was very like, but you're not allowed to make claims like this on supplements. Yes. It's the FDA regulates that. So we got an FDA letter. it was addressed to
Dr.
me.
Dr. Tro loves to share it.
People love to bring it up. Cause I'm like, I'm very honest about it. I'm like, I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know what was going on, but the claims that you're discussing reduces fatigue, the greatest supplement out there. I'm surprised the FDA is, the FDA, someone's probably going to go, you can't do that.
She found a loophole and God, that's,
well,
it is.
So the other thing is that we, you know, obviously it's not on the market yet, but there is a way to report fraudulent claims made by supplements because they are not regulated by the FDA for safety and efficacy. They cannot make claims about helping medical issues, right? They cannot make those. And is an HHS reporting platform that you can use. It's how, what was that company that just got, that got banned? The one that was all over MSNBC, Balance of Nature. Oh, wow. They were doing the same thing. They were saying it cured COVID and it did all this. So if you make, but the problem is that the FDA can't step in until after the product's on the shelf. So it requires people to file these claims that they are making false statements about benefits, because supplements are not regulated as medications, so they cannot make those claims.
You know what I find ironic about this whole thing? So aren't she and Peter Attia kind of buddies or something? Because they both like over exaggerate the CGM claims.
And Mark Hyman as well.
Oh yeah, Mark Hyman, that's right. Well, so he's the one that tells everyone, even healthy people, to take metformin for longevity, which has zero data for it. And so now we have these, like, these two sort of discordant extremes. Like, metformin is a very good medication, has a lot of efficacy and safety data for people with type 2 diabetes, even pre-diabetes, diabetes prevention, bringing glucose levels down, like I said, preventing microvascular complications, probably having some overall, you know, heart and mortality benefits with it too. But that's for people with diabetes, mind you. So people without any diabetes, I still would never tell anybody to. I don't take it, and it's cheap, and we have a ton of efficacy and safety data, let alone some random supplement that has a few people in a couple of studies that helps maybe minimize prandial excursions, and we have zero long-term data for it. And maybe it's fine, but God, I'd rather spend $1 a month on metformin than $65 on a supplement. And I still wouldn't do it because it's medicine. We shouldn't be taking drugs if we don't need it. The more risk you have and the more we know the benefits of medications and supplements in anyhow, then the better the risk to benefit profile is. Over-the-counter orlistat, lipase inhibitor, it's literally approved medicine for obesity, but it is over-the-counter, by the way, and it has good efficacy and safety data for obesity and some, you know, lipids and diabetes things. Absolutely better worth your money. Way more safety data and actually has some benefits other than oily stools.
Carl opened the door, and I want to make sure that we touch on the CGM phenomenon, because this goes hand in hand, right? Yeah. She made her mark selling these books called the Glucose Revolution and the Glucose Goddess Method, all of these hacks for healthy people to make sure that their blood sugar is never changing, which we know is absurd, and, you know, it should change. But she also obviously aligns with people and herself recommending this CGM, continuous glucose monitors, which we know are not evidence-based for people who are not pre-diabetic or diabetic. So maybe, Spencer, you can kind of summarize, you know, the potential issues with CGMs, especially in combination with these other pathology issues of, you know, demonizing blood sugar.
Yeah, I don't want to stop people from being curious. I've done it myself. And if you're going to do it, if you're going to get a seat, because you're like, oh, this is kind of interesting, I just kind of want to see. If you're going to do it, make sure you have somebody that you're working with that helps you understand things like exercise, just blueberries, whatever. These things can spike your glucose. And if you just kind of blindly follow someone who says glucose spikes are bad for you, it will cause anxiety. So if you're just going to do it, because I know people are probably listening, like, I want to try it. I just kind of want to try it. I want to see what it's like. Make sure you have just the proper guidance of doing it. Otherwise, I would strongly not recommend doing it if you don't have anybody to help you coach you through it, who understands it, by the way, not just somebody
who's a trustworthy person. Not the low carb zealots, because they're going to tell you to eat bacon instead of a banana.
Yeah, no, that's what we always bring up, the bacon instead of blueberries. Like, imagine the bacon's not going to spike your blood sugar afterwards, but a couple cups of blueberries will.
So you can also eat a stick of butter. It's not going to do anything to your sugar.
Yeah. So I would, if you're healthy, you've never had blood sugar problems, you know, I probably wouldn't do it. We already know the things that are going to be helpful for you, staying lean as much as possible, having a good dietary pattern, regardless of if there's fruit and other carbohydrate containing foods in their physical activity and sleep. And if you do use a CGM, I wouldn't start taking extra supplements just to kind of blunt the spikes of your blood sugars. Again, unless you're talking to a doctor who says, yeah, it looks like you have some insulin resistance. And in which case I would use FDA approved medicines instead.
Well, and And I think, you know, you raised a great point there, which is, you know, if you're wearing it because you're simply curious, that's one thing. But I think nowadays people are getting to this habit of wearing it and using it to inform the decisions they make about the foods they're eating and the behaviors they're doing. And we know that avoiding some of these very nutrient dense and fibrous foods that will lead to a perfectly normal and expected increase in blood sugar can lead to other health impacts, right? We've talked about fiber and how it's really important in preventing gastrointestinal diseases and cancers. And, you know, we are seeing rises in certain types of cancers. So, you know, we don't know if that's a link, but again, it's not, you know, blood glucose is not the only thing that informs your health. And there's really no evidence that healthy people need to be monitoring this. There was a small study that looked at healthy people without diabetes, and they found that 96% of the time, all of those people were within the 80 to 140 milligram per deciliter range every time they looked at a reading. So,
and that's the study in healthy people on CGM to show what is kind of normal and healthy. Only 2% of the time which is 30 minutes a day, did people spend over 140, mind you.
And does that even matter?
Exactly.
I don't know.
No. And that little bit, maybe, but that little bit is not much.
Exactly.
And like you said, there are other things, even in, by the way, type 2 diabetes, type 1 diabetes, who we treat all day long in endocrinology and cardiology and stuff, we are trying to not be what we call glucose centric. There is so much more to health than just their glucose levels. Like I just said, we can get only so much bang for the buck by getting their average sugars down and preventing those complications, but we don't want to cause other harm just to do it. And we got to think much more holistically. For example, someone with heart disease and kidney disease, they might have an A1C of 6, but they should actually be on some of these medications like a GLP-1 receptor agonist and SGLT2 inhibitors to reduce the risk of heart disease and kidney disease later on.
And not mulberry extract.
And not mulberry extract. But yes, their sugars will get even better and they'll have normal sugars now.
That's great. I think that's the perfect point to wrap up on, right? You know, if you have complex health issues, history, concerns, you shouldn't be taking the advice of someone who's selling a supplement on social media and is making claims that are outside the scope of what data are saying and not factoring in the very complex relationship that we have with our bodies and beyond simply looking at blood glucose. So thank you, Nadolski boys, for joining us. This was a really, really thorough discussion, I think. Hopefully it will alleviate some of the questions and concerns that folks had about Glucose Goddess and this new anti-spike supplement. So thank you again for joining us. We hope you learned a thing or two. And if you want to support our efforts and help us grow the reach of Unbiased Science, check out our website. We have our weekly newsletter, which is at theunbiasedscipod.substack.com. Our website is www.unbiasedscipod.com. And make sure to subscribe to our YouTube and all of our social handles. The handle is at unbiasedscipod. Catch you next time on the pod, your trusted source for no nonsense, just science.